This is NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. The rental market is doing very well in the Twin Cities. Vacancies are low. Rent is rising. That's good news if you're a landlord or a property developer, but sometimes it's not always such good news if you're renting. If you're stuck in a bad apartment with a terrible landlord, you're short on options. Today we're going to talk about the rental market in the Twin Cities, what it means for renters and landlords. I'm joined by two guests. Sam Young is a regional economist with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. He joins us on the line from Chicago. And Luke Grundman is an attorney with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. He works on cases involving tenants, evictions, foreclosures, things like that. He's here in the studio. Maybe you've been having trouble finding a place to live or had trouble with a landlord. Maybe you're a landlord who's had trouble with a tenant. Let us know what happened. Get your question in. Give us a call. 651-227-6000 is the number. 651-227-6000. Luke Grundman, Sam Young, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Sam, let me start with you, if I can. Can you give us a quick overview of what the rental market looks like in the Twin Cities right now?
Sure. The market in Minneapolis has been, or I should say the Twin Cities, it has always been slightly tight for the last 5 years. It's ranged from 2.5% to 3.5% vacancy rate. Rents have risen on average 3% to 5% annually. And it seems that as fast as builders build apartments, they are absorbed. The strong economy allows those markets to be absorbed.
I was going to ask you about that because it seems like there's hardly a day goes by without a story in the newspaper. Some big apartment development is in the works. So where does the demand come from? Is it just from more people moving into the area?
Migration is definitely part of it. Some of it is just household formation. You know, people feel better about the economy as a whole, and so they're more apt to form a household. And the new transit options and the expanded transit options downtown are encouraging that development, especially close to those transit centers.
And there's also an issue. You hear a lot of talk about affordable housing, and some of the stories you see about the new apartments being built, they're called luxury apartments or market rate apartments. So what's the difference? Just give us a quick rundown. What does it mean when we talk about affordable housing? What does it mean when we talk about market rate apartments? And what about luxury apartments?
Well, I'll start with market rate. That's the largest umbrella, and that's the normal, what we would call conventional apartment. And they generally break those down by tiers, Class A, Class B, and Class C. And that's generally based on the level of amenities. And so you can have a very amenity-rich, which would possibly classify as luxury, lots and lots of amenities. And then Class B is a more entry-level apartment. And then Class C generally looks at older apartment stock, but still part of that conventional market.
Okay.
Affordable can be tricky. Some people say apartments with low rents are affordable, but we have to be careful that affordable is generally means income restricted in some way. So a low-income housing tax credit or TIF-financed unit that's targeted to people with income restrictions.
So that's like Section 8 housing?
Yes, that's one component of that, yes.
Okay. That's Sam Young. He's an economist with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, also joined by Luke Grundman, who's a lawyer with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. And Luke, let's bring you into the conversation. If it's a pretty tight market and rents are going up, what kind of problems does that create for people who are looking to rent?
Oh, that's a great question, Mike, and thanks for having me here. The one thing I'd say is high rents are bad for everyone. If you're a college student who's looking for an apartment, may have to move in with more roommates and that sort of thing. But for my clients, who are mostly people who are low income, the high rental market or the tight rental market and the high rents really cause problems. And the main thing that it does is it forces them into some horrible choices, some heart-wrenching decisions about, do I report my landlord because of the horrible conditions in my apartment, or am I too worried about finding another place to live so I don't want to rock the boat or to do anything about that? The number one thing that we see at Legal Aid about how it affects renters right now is that they don't have the choices that they otherwise would. When the vacancy rate is at 8 or 10%, you know, then the possibility of being evicted or getting retaliated against by a landlord isn't such a big deal. But when there's no place else to go and families have to face the very real possibility of homelessness if they take on their landlords, then that creates a power dynamic where the tenants are really put into horrible decision-making.
And how often does that happen? I mean, how often does a landlord retaliate against somebody for, say, complaining about the conditions in the apartment?
Sure. And I'll say, you know, most landlords out there are good professional landlords and they're great companies. But for particularly for our clients, for folks who are low income, who are trying to make it work on minimum wage or working as hard as they can to try to make ends meet, for those folks, the landlords that they have to deal with, it's almost all of them. It's a predatory class of landlords out there who have buildings that are unsafe and unhealthy for people to live in. And so that a tenant has to say, okay, I have to make this choice between do I keep living here, where we have a client right now who's afraid to put her child on the floor to crawl around because the cockroaches are so bad. Mm. And so that the child is not developing as fast as she otherwise could. But for the client, when there's no other housing out there that's available, she doesn't believe that she has a real choice. And whether or not the landlord will actually retaliate, which does happen quite often in our work, and whether or not there's a lawyer there to try to help her with that, you know, she has to try to make that decision without perfect knowledge about what may or may not happen.
That's Luke Grundman. He's an attorney with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Also on the line with us today, Sam Young, who's a regional economist with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. We're talking about renting. What are your options, especially in a tight market, which is what we have in the Twin Cities now, as we've heard Sam describe it. You can join the conversation. You can either tell us your experience or ask us a question. 651-227-6000 is the number. 651-227-6000. And Luke, let me just ask you, in a situation like this where, you know, it seems like a health hazard, is there any way when you're getting into the property, when you're looking for a place to rent, that you can prepare for that? Can you find something specific in the rental agreement and let the landlord know that if it's not safe, you're going to report him? How should you handle that?
Absolutely. And I mean, a good tenant who has all the resources available and all the knowledge about what they can or can't do should definitely take a close look at the place, make sure that it is healthy, it is safe, it's up to a basic level of human standards and decency, as the law does require. But I think what the problem is for folks who don't have that opportunity and challenging the landlord on the conditions of the property at move-in could potentially just lead them to be retaliated against, or they just won't get the apartment.
The landlord says, I'll rent to somebody else.
Absolutely. And so when there's a very tight vacancy rate, which for folks who are low income, I think the vacancy rate is really zero in a large case. And when we talk about vacancy rates across the whole rental market, we're not really focusing on people who have evictions on their records and who have very low income, so that it's extremely difficult to find housing. I think the vacancy rate is a lot lower. And in that environment, there's not really a market at work where the tenant doesn't have a real choice about where they can live. They have to take what they can to keep a roof over their children's heads. So that really changes the choices they can make, and it changes how aggressive they can be with their landlord. Mm. Another thing that often happens is the place may look fine when they first view it. I've had a client who, when she first looked at the place, it looked fine. It was clean and seemed to be in relatively decent shape. But within a few days, the mice started to come out. And we're talking about 14 mice caught in one sticky trap in one night, you know, just a massive mouse infestation in a property that you wouldn't notice just by walking through it the first time you took a look at the apartment. And then the landlord, of course, refused to make the repairs, didn't want to do anything about it. Months go by, and that tenant has to try to finally, you know, make it to legal aid so we can help her bring a case against the landlord. But before that happens, she was just stuck with those conditions and very few options.
Sam Young, does HUD look at those variations in the cost of housing and people's income who might be able to afford it? Do you see those figures, that it is really a much tighter market for people without much money?
Yes, when we look at a market, we definitely look at the vacancy rates and the rents by product type. And so it's not only apartments, but they're also, you know, smaller landlords who rent single-family homes or townhomes, and all of the different tiers, you know, the luxury and the Class B, Class C, they all experience different market dynamics.
Okay. Let's take a caller. It looks like, I'm not sure if it's Cotty or Scotty on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi, it's Cotty.
Okay.
It's like Scotty with the last.
Okay.
I just had a quick comment. My wife and I own a small apartment building in South Minneapolis with very, very long-term tenants. One of them has been there 61 years. But over the last 4 years, 15, 16, 17, and 18, our taxes have gone up 70%. And there's a point where we just can't continue to subsidize lower rents based on astronomical tax increases. And, you know, I just want you to think about that. Maybe have a chat with, we need to have a chat with the city and the county.
Okay, and it's property taxes basically going up?
Yes. Property taxes have gone up. If I include what to do in 19, it looks like it'll be closer to 80% increase over 5 years.
Wow. Have you gone to the county or gone to the tax hearings and tried to raise the ruckus with anybody?
I will be this year. I've kind of avoided it. But there is, if I took the assessed value of my building to a bank and tried to borrow money against it, they would just laugh. There isn't a chance on earth that you could get a normal loan to match anything near what the county is saying it's worth.
Okay. Luke Grundman, what about that? Property taxes an issue for landlords?
Absolutely. And I don't think, well, for sure at Legal Aid, I don't think that anyone is saying that a landlord should not have to raise the rents to match their expenses. And it sounds like with a tenant who's been in your building that long, that this must be a pretty well-run building.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the landlords really who don't want to have to pay out the externalities that they ought to, which mean keeping a place healthy and safe. And that because that just eats right into their profit margins. But absolutely, property taxes going up, that when housing gets more expensive for homeowners, it directly gets more expensive for tenants as well. It's just that in our work, what we see is that it's the tenants oftentimes who are bearing the biggest brunt of that, because from the irresponsible landlords, probably not like Cotty, who are out there and charging very high rents because the market will support that, but not put using those rents to make the basic levels of repairs that they ought to be doing.
Let's take another caller, Larry on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi, I'm both an attorney who does work with low-income tenants, and I've also been a landlord off and on for about 30 years. And some things I'd like the guests to talk about are, one, do rents ever really go down, or do they just flatten out and then continue to go up? Another thought I've got is just part of the problem for low-income folks is, you know, not surprisingly, their income is low. And what the guests would say about increases in minimum wage as a way to make apartments affordable. And the last thing I've seen is that a lot of folks are kind of captive to the apartments they're in because their incomes are low. They don't have a bank account. They're paycheck to paycheck. And so they don't have money to – I mean, it's kind of expensive to move from one place to another, not just the moving, but you have to be able to pay a deposit or first month's rent and a last month's rent while you're still paying rent where you are and you haven't gotten that deposit back from your last place. So if your guests could say some things about those topics, I'd be interested.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you. Great question. Sam Young, let me start with you. Do rents ever go down?
Yes, they do. And especially if you look at what is we would term effective rent versus asking rent, you know, when you factor in concessions or things like that, effective rents can absolutely go down if a market is out of whack for a short time, if there's too much building, or if people are leaving an area. Yes, that rents will go down.
And does building more units necessarily bring the rent down?
Not by itself. That may help, but not by itself.
Huh. So even though it seems like the construction market is going, that might not necessarily reduce rents.
Correct. Yeah, the simplest answer is correct.
Huh. Wow. Luke, what about some of the other questions the caller raised? I mean, a great point I thought he made. People just don't have the money to move around when you have to put up a damage deposit or the first and last month rent, and you're trying to pay this month's rent.
Absolutely, and I think one study that is sort of striking is that what we've seen is it takes approximately 80 hours of minimum wage before a tenant can afford the average rent that they would need in order to rent in the city of Minneapolis right now. And so that
say that again, so because it went by me quick.
That for a tenant who's working, and most of our clients are, they're hardworking folks who are just trying to get by. But if they're working at our current minimum wage, that it would take them 80 hours per week of work in order to pay the rent that at the average rent levels that we're seeing for if they have a few kids and they need a building that's large enough to suit them. So absolutely, raising the minimum wage is definitely a way that we can increase the affordability of apartments and start to bring a little more of that power back to the tenants. The other thing you mentioned about damage deposits, I think, is a really good point. What we see right now, especially in certain neighborhoods, North Minneapolis, one of them, is landlords who've really made a business out of evictions. And they do that by charging a double or a triple deposit and then knowing that an eviction may cost them a few hundred bucks, but there's really no incentive for them not to evict a tenant. In fact, the data show that some of those landlords will evict every single tenant who comes through their doors, and they'll evict two or three families out of the same unit in the same year. And that sort of predatory business model is another thing that I think is really driving up rents and driving a lot of that insecurity where tenants don't believe they can really challenge their landlords.
What limits are there on what a landlord can do? Is it against the law to evict somebody, or do you have to have good reason? How does that work?
Absolutely, there has to be a good reason to evict someone. And there's 6,000 evictions in Hennepin County per year right now. So it's just a lot of evictions. Right now, a given Monday, there's 40 families facing eviction in Hennepin County as we speak. And for those folks, yes, a lot of them have defenses. They have legal defenses to those evictions. But there's not enough lawyers to go around. And so a lot of them don't know that the landlord may have done something improperly or that they have the right to raise the unsafe and unhealthy conditions in their property as defenses to that eviction case. But most tenants just don't know that, and there aren't really enough of us lawyers to go around to tell them about it.
And I know another issue that comes up with evictions is what they call an unlawful detainer. Explain what that is and how that happens.
Sure. Unlawful detainer is an older way of referring to the type of court case that today is called an eviction action. So when people talk about an eviction case, an unlawful detainer, really they're the same thing. But we see the term a lot. It's kind of out there in the common lingo that people use. And the way it comes up oftentimes is when people say, or landlords will say, that we won't rent to you if you have an unlawful detainer on your record. Well, with 6,000 evictions or unlawful detainers taking place every year in Hennepin County alone, that's a lot of folks who are pushed into the type of rental market that I've been talking about, the type of rental market where they're taken advantage of by predatory landlords. Those unlawful detainers, or if you go on Craigslist and search for rental vacancies right now, you'll see no UDs, meaning no unlawful detainers or no evictions. But because many of those cases really should never have been filed in the first place, and there were legal defenses to them, the tenant is still nevertheless punished by them and forced into less ideal housing situations just because the case was even filed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter for purposes of these prospective landlords whether the case had any merit to it or anything. The tenant is still punished by it.
And is the only recourse to go to court, to go to somebody like you to try to get this straightened out?
Absolutely. I mean, for tenants out there, the lesson here is despite all the gloom and doom, is that they do have some power, and that our clients, by and large, are very strong people. They're just overwhelmed with all the other things that are going on in their lives that it takes. When you're a poor person, it's hard to get through your average day. But that what they need to do is to stand up to their landlords, and they do need to come to legal aid or to come to court and to try to advocate for themselves and to make sure that they don't just allow these practices to continue, despite the fact that we're in such a low vacancy market.
Let's take another quick call before we break for news. Jordan is on the line from Roseville.
Hi, thanks for having me. I was just giving a personal account of, you know, something that I've been experiencing right now, and it is pretty much directly what one of your guests was saying with the retaliation. So I'm on a month-to-month lease right now, so that puts me at a disadvantage because versus an eviction, they have to have a reason. With this, they don't. So I have been working with somebody and have had a retaliation notice because with all the requests that I've made after that, immediately after I had a notice that I have to end the lease, which now that puts me in a position where, you know, it affects my job. It affects where I'm going to live, if I can find anywhere. And, you know, with where the market is right now, there is no places for single housing under $1,000 a month. So it just goes directly to, I believe, what Lucas was saying. With that, it just limits so much of what you can do and disrupts your entire life.
And so, and then, just so I'm clear, you made a request of the landlord to fix something or to maintain the building?
Yeah, it's a very, very old building, and there's been many issues with it, you know, from pests to mold and, you know, broken appliances. And, you know, immediately after one of the requests, I had a notice the next day that the lease would end.
Okay.
And so now the issue is I either have to make the decision to fight it, which is going to take up a lot of time, or just move, which is also going to take up a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, thanks for the call. Luke Grundman, if you're on a month-to-month lease situation, is there anything you can do to fight it if the landlord says, I'm out, you're out?
There is something that the caller can do about it, and I'd encourage her to do it. But what the law says is even under a month-to-month lease scenario, if the landlord is retaliating by giving the notice to vacate or the notice to terminate the tenancy, then that's an illegal termination of the lease. And the court, the judge in the eviction proceeding, will say, no, you cannot evict under these circumstances. This notice is invalid because it is retaliatory. And the law even goes further than that in Minnesota. We have a better retaliation statute than a lot of states in the country. And it says that the law will presume that a notice to vacate is retaliatory. And the landlord has to prove that it's not retaliatory if the notice to vacate was given within 90 days after the act that the tenant did that she believes she's being retaliated against for. So there's a 90-day period. If there's a notice to vacate given during that period, then the judge will assume that it's a retaliatory notice until the landlord can prove otherwise.
We're talking about housing this hour. That's Luke Grundman. He's an attorney with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Sam Young is on the line with us, too, from Chicago. He's an economist with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And Sam Young, let me just go back to you to bring up a point we talked about before. You said building more apartment buildings doesn't necessarily bring down the rent, but the rent does come down sometimes. What would it take for rent to drop?
That's a market dynamic. Absolutely. If you build, for a market to be in balance, to answer correctly, you need to build enough rental units as there are renter households demanding them, and then you would have balance. And so you can create short-term dislocations by building too much or faster than renter households demand them, and that will bring rents down. But to do this long-term as a decision to bring rents down, that's trying to pull on the levers that even I don't know if I could figure all that out.
Well, I think you said earlier in the program that for the past 3 to 5 years, the vacancy rate has been around 2.5% to 3.5%.
Correct. Yeah, since 2012, if you look at Marquette Advisors, the vacancy rate has ranged between 2.5% and 3.5%. And the market has built about 4,100 new market rate units every year, but those have been absorbed in the Twin Cities area.
Wow, that's pretty amazing when you think about it. More than 4,000 units every year. And is there a place where you, as an economist, look and say, this is sort of an ideal vacancy rate that benefits both the landlords and the tenants?
Well, if you were to look at a national rule of thumb, 5% is generally the number that's used for a balanced vacancy rate. That allows for churn of people moving in and out of apartments, and that allows for the reasonable change in rents. But an area like New York City, a balanced vacancy rate is much less because of other factors.
Mm-hmm. So we're definitely in the Twin Cities under that 5% number.
Correct.
And doesn't look like that's going to change anytime soon.
No. Now, in 2018, there are projected to be 6,600 units to be constructed this year, which could allow vacancy rates to move up a little bit. Now, whether that will last depends on how fast those units are absorbed.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the economy, at least in terms of the unemployment rate, is pretty strong here. And so you would imagine that people would keep coming looking for work.
Correct, yes.
Okay. Let's take another caller. Lisa is on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi.
Hi.
I have another kind of issue in this, and that is seeing some helping, trying to help people get into housing, and one of the big issues is application fees. It seems that the landlords, you know, I see these some people struggling with $40 application fees and with no guarantee of rental, and I just think that there should be some kind of a limit to how much should be allowed to be charged for an application fee. And I also see it as a source of an opportunity for discrimination.
Hmm. Good question. Let me ask Luke Grundman about it. So this is not a damage deposit or, first month's rent. This is just for the privilege of applying to rent an apartment?
Yes, that's correct. And this is a growing issue that we've seen. The law says that if a landlord will collect or charge an application fee, that fee actually has to go towards the act of processing the application. But we see a lot of abuse of that law or of that practice as well. We see cases where 5, 6, 10 applications will be accepted for one vacant unit. And so we have a strong suspicion that the landlord is not using the money collected from all 10 of those applicants to actually go towards background checks or other things that might be legitimate charges for a landlord to have. They're just pocketing the change and using that to add to their profit margins. Hmm. And again, you know, there are a lot of very good professional management companies out there who would never do such a thing. I don't want to loop them all into this, but this is just another very, very illegal and dangerous practice. But it's also one that's very hard for us to get at because folks, all the tenant really knows is, well, I paid my application fee and later I was told I was denied, but there's not a lot of process or understanding about why that happened. And so we see landlords, again, taking advantage of that as a process to just add to their profit margins.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the concern is if I don't put the fee up, I might not get the apartment and I really need a place to live.
Exactly. It's preying upon the desperation of tenants and people who want to be tenants who are currently homeless.
Okay. Let's take another caller, Tim in Minneapolis.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'd just like to make a comment on, how the current tax code kind of discourages improvements into properties and also, you know, kind of forces rent up. I own a single duplex unit in Minneapolis that I rent out. And if I want to make an improvement, whether it's something small like a new refrigerator in a unit, I'm forced to put that on a schedule over 20 years. So $1,000 write-off over 20 years is minimal, but on a single unit like I own, I'm only cash flowing a couple thousand a year. That's half my profit for the year, and I'm forced to write it off, you know, which really makes me forced to put that cost onto the renter.
Mm-hmm. Huh. So just explain this a little better for me because sure. I don't own a rental property, but if you buy a new refrigerator, you can't just write it off. You have to
1 year.
You
correct.
Have to schedule it over a number of years.
Huh. Over 20 years.
Wow.
So what's $1,000 over 20 years? It discourages landlords to invest in their property because they make them. So I have to take out of my pocket. Let's say it was a $20,000 improvement. I wanted to put all new windows in my unit. I have to take $20,000 out of my pocket that year to do the windows, but they make me schedule it over 20 years. So I only get $1,000 a year write-off which makes zero impact on my taxes for the rental, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a big investment out of my pocket. So it really discourages people from improving their properties the way the tax schedule is set up.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Luke, is this something you have experience with?
I'll be honest, I'm not a tax lawyer,
uh-huh.
and I don't know exactly how this shakes out. I had thought that that sort of carried forward deduction was optional for landlords, but I can't speak to that exactly. I'm not a tax attorney. I agree with the caller, though, that if that is the case, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So what mm-hmm. we need right now is landlords to put investment into their properties to bring them up to basic habitable conditions. And so if tax policy is making that more difficult, then it should change.
Well, let me just bring Sam Young back in. And Sam, are you aware of that? It seems like landlords or property owners, rental property owners, are treated differently from a regular homeowner in the tax code, right?
I believe so. But yeah, the tax code is far outside my knowledge base.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take another caller, James from Brooklyn Park.
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes. I think the biggest problem in the Twin Cities here is that the housing crisis is really rooted in greed and greedy landlords. This is not a supply problem because the limited supply does not give the landlord the right to make all metro rent units affordable or non-affordable. This is an elephant in the room that no one will address. Landlord's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It's the landlord's behavior. The landlord's behaving very badly. They stick together. They all come together. When it becomes a landlord and tenant issue, the landlord is always going to trump the downtown city council. Everybody is pro-landlord. Nobody's pro-tenant in this state. The tenants get messed over because there's a lot of high-end rental property going up, but very little low-income property going up. And a lot of those high-end properties that's on the North Loop in downtown Minneapolis, it's not even half occupied. So what's the problem with all the high-end property that's going up? And I'd like for Mr. Young to address that the UD problem is unlawful detainer. That's after you become a problem property renter in Chicago and you're asked not to return to that property. They use unlawful detainers, that word, totally different and totally wrong in this state to keep low-income and minorities in the look one apartment rat.
Okay. Thanks for the call, James. Sam Young, let me ask you a question about what he raised there, and that is that a lot of high-end apartments are going up, but not a lot of low-end or affordable apartments. Is that true in the Twin Cities?
That's correct. Yeah, and earlier when I stated that there's projected to be 6,600 market-rate units to be built in the Twin Cities in 2018, there are projected to be 500 non-senior affordable units to be built in the same period.
But wow.
Just to give you a comparison.
Yeah, that's quite a discrepancy or quite a gap. Luke, do the landlords stick together?
And I'll just repeat what I said before, too, is that there's a whole community of landlords, and there's very different types of landlords out there. And the vast majority are business people who just want to run a business, and they want to do a good job doing it. But that it's really, and I'm not sure if the caller is one of them or not, but there is a group of folks out there who are subject to the worst practices. And for those folks, it is a completely different rental market than it is for others. And it does have, just as the caller mentioned, I mean, there is a racial justice component to this. And it's borne out in what we see in our clients who face evictions. 80% of them are people of color. 60% are African-American. Almost 70% are households that are headed by women. Most have children in their homes. Half of the people who live in North Minneapolis right now have faced an eviction within the last 3 years. And that community, of course, is a community that's very much a community of color. And so that this eviction crisis that we're going through right now, which is a component of the lack of affordable housing and the low vacancy rates, It is an eviction crisis that disproportionately affects people of color. And it becomes a problem that exacerbates the disparities in our communities, not just for people today, but generationally as well.
Absolutely. Well, what can we do about it? I mean, you're taking it on sort of a case-by-case basis. What's the systemic solution?
I think there are a lot of things, and I'll say that a lot of folks out there right now are focused on this issue. It's become, thanks to some reporting by NPR as well, that there are more people who are paying attention to evictions and to the lack of available housing right now. And I couldn't name all of them, but a lot of people who are thinking about this and trying to develop some solutions. One that, of course, is near to what and dear to what I do is to give more tenants lawyers. We've seen New York right now is giving a right to counsel to every tenant facing eviction. And what they're seeing is that will actually save taxpayers money by forcing landlords to think twice before filing evictions or before making that part of their business model. And it will also help by avoiding homelessness, avoiding shelter usage. It can actually save taxpayer money, and it certainly can help a lot in terms of that family avoiding homelessness and the sort of family instability that evictions cause. So one idea that's out there right now is to just give more tenants lawyers so that they can defend themselves, know their rights, and keep families more stable.
But it sounds like a political solution is called for, right? And whether it's making some of these tax adjustments or increasing the penalties for people who are just evicting folks willy-nilly, I mean, something needs to happen at City Hall or at the state legislature, right?
Or both. I think at all levels right now there are things that can be changed that would make big impacts. And I am glad to see that, at least in the city of Minneapolis, a lot of city council members are focused on this. They want to make changes. I think there are more discussions at the state level as well. I think it's a both and right now. There are a lot of things out there that by making small changes we could do a lot of good for people.
Had a caller earlier, Marcus from Minneapolis, who said he has an unlawful detainer on his credit. How can he remove it?
So what Marcus needs to do, and for all tenants out there, is they'll have to file a motion in court. It's called an expungement motion. It's effectively a way of asking the judge who was assigned to the case to take a look at the individual facts of that case and decide that it really doesn't need to be on that person's record anymore. There's a state law that governs expungements. It forces the tenant to show that the case never should have been filed in the first place. So if 5-6 years have gone by, that can be difficult for a tenant to do. Some of the judicial officers in Hennepin County, at least, have helped Legal Aid really change the outlook on expungements by granting more expungements under what's called their inherent authority. It's really just looking more at the whole picture of that tenant situation and try to figure out from a balancing standpoint, is there any real need for the public to know about this eviction versus the tenant's need to find new housing? Expungements are a big deal. Between Legal Aid and our sister organization, the Volunteer Lawyers Network, we file about 800 expungement motions per year. It's a lot of work for each individual case to try to get that off someone's record, but it can do a lot of good for them because one eviction is always upstream from another eviction. If a family is evicted, they're more likely to be evicted again. And if we can stop that eviction, if we can keep it off their record, it keeps that family from becoming part of that group of folks that predatory landlords can prey upon because they don't have any other choices.
All right, lots of people standing by on the phone. Let's go back to Don in Minneapolis. Hi, Don, go ahead.
Hey, I just had kind of a comment that was piggybacking. I missed the discussion by like 2 minutes, but I've been living in Minneapolis for about 2.5 years now, and the first place I lived, we moved out of there after the first year because they were going to ask us to pay $800 more a month than we started out paying. And, you know, that combined with seeing, I think it's been 3 already, luxury apartment buildings going up in the Como neighborhood since I've moved here has just been kind of crazy. I mean, I don't think that, you know, there are a lot of landlords that are just like single people who are just, you know, they own a couple of units and they're just like kind of a mom and pop business. But I think there's been kind of a problem with landlord companies around Minneapolis being kind of predatory.
Okay. Sam Young, let me ask you, it sounds like the economics are a little out of whack here. If these luxury units are going up and people who need houses can't afford them, making minimum wage. How do you get that into balance?
Well, there's a couple different arguments, and some would say that the easiest way is just build more apartments, and that would, if you even if you build luxury apartments, that will force filtration of existing units down the tier and become more afford and create more affordable supply at the lower end of the market. That's one argument. And the other argument is to incentivize developers to build affordable product. And we have noticed here in the Chicago office that developers that come to HUD seeking FHA mortgage insurance for multifamily development are including some low-income units as part of their regular conventional development. So if they are building 100 units, say 10 of those would be available to those with income restrictions.
And what's the incentive for a developer to do that?
They work with the state through, and they can get TIF financing, which is tax increment financing, or they can get low-income housing tax credits, and that allows them to pencil these projects out.
Okay. Another caller, Mark from Fridley.
Thank you for taking my call. For a lot of the small-time landlords, it's not a very profitable venture at all. The cost of the properties, the cost of purchasing a property, is driven by the market rent, and the small-time landlord is waiting for the rent to slowly nudge upward so that it can become profitable. So the if a profit motive is, by definition, greed or immoral, I don't have an argument for that. But for a lot of the small-time landlords, they're just not a lot of money in it. It's not a very profitable venture.
What change could happen that would make it more profitable for you? Would it be some kind of tax incentive or what?
The raise in rent. Rents to slowly go up, or if I could purchase properties with lower debt, but purchasing properties is not inexpensive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for the call. Luke Grundman, any response to that caller?
No, I mean, I think I don't disagree that that's likely true. And I think there are a lot of mom and pop landlords out there who do just want to do a good job and want to be and want to make a little profit. And there's, of course, nothing illegal about that. But that I guess the point we're trying to make, and it's not that this particular caller is not doing this or that other ones aren't, but it's that the law says if you want to be a landlord, you have to provide a healthy and safe home for your tenants, just like a restaurant has to be basically kept up to sanitary conditions in order to be a restaurant. There's licensing standards, there's basic human decency standards. And if it costs too much to do that and to still be a landlord, then then maybe it's not the right business for folks, or it's not the right property for folks or something. But that we cannot, as a society, we've decided that places have to be kept in basic habitable conditions, and it's not okay to say, well, I'm going to keep the price low and therefore I'll just skimp out on all the obligations that I have.
Mm-hmm. And one last caller, Davis in Eagan.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. For a tenant who is on Section 8, on a Section 8 voucher that is renting a single-family unit that got sold within the last couple of weeks, and was given a 30-day notice to vacate, what options does she have to even extend the notice to vacate to maybe 60 days to be able to allow her to be able to find other help?
Luke?
Sure, and I'd just say that that's definitely the type of case that if this person lives in our service area, that legal aid could likely represent her on that case. It's the type of scenario we see a lot. It will take some, just to answer the question more directly, it'll take some negotiations with the landlord, certainly. There may be, after we investigate, there may be a legal hook to try to challenge that notice to vacate. There are laws that apply to those, as we talked about retaliation before, but even barring retaliation, landlords do have to follow the law when they give a notice to vacate. And if there's some inconsistency there, it can give us the legal hook to try to open up a negotiation with the landlord. And the Section 8 or the housing authority that administers Section 8 will oftentimes be willing to go along with a settlement like that. But it's a case that I'd say that person should give us a call if they're in our service area. Otherwise, there are legal aid organizations that cover the state of Minnesota.
Sam Young, what do you see as the future of the Twin Cities rental market if the current trend continues?
I would say that it's going to continue to operate, and I would say healthy, because you're going to continue to see projects coming in, and you'll see households grow. Whether that is affordable to every household, that will be an ongoing challenge, not just for the Twin Cities, but metropolitan areas across the country.
And Luke Grundman, if somebody's really having a problem, what should they do?
I think they should give us a call. And we're not the only game in town. Of course, there's other legal aid organizations. There's other great advocacy organizations for tenants. But the message is that you should know you do have rights and that you ought to know about them before you make decisions.
Luke Grundman, attorney with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Sam Young from HUD in Chicago, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Good conversation. Thanks to everyone who called as well. Tomorrow we'll be talking about lakes in Minnesota. Pick your favorite and tell us why. We'll see you then.